KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS Falls Pass.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Zime, and this hour, Pope Francis has been honored and laid to rest in Rome.
I think that the number of young people that today are here says a lot. We have loved him. We love him.
We will have details about the Pope's open-air mass and his legacy. Then U.S. federal workers who've been fired find they've lost health coverage they thought was guaranteed. Sports, including a hometown team's tribute to Pope Francis. And Jason Bailey's new book on James Gandolfini remembers the actor who played a mobster but was really a gentle soul. First, we have our newscast. Today is Saturday, April 26, 2025.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Tens of thousands of people lined the streets in Rome today to witness the funeral procession for Pope Francis, who died on Monday. They clapped and cheered as the Pope's wooden coffin made its way to its final resting place. Earlier today in Vatican City, massive crowds gathered in St. Peter's Square for the Pope's funeral service. NPR's Ruth Sherlock was there and filed this report.
Pope Francis's casket, a simple wooden casket per the requests he made in his will, is in front of the altar on the steps of St. Peter's Square. The setting of this funeral only amplifies the spectacle here. Grand stone colonnades to either side of me, and above them 140 statues representing Catholic saints. There's a feeling standing here in the crowd, people tell me, that Pope Francis is watching all this from the blue sky above us.
NPR's Ruth Sherlock reporting. The Kremlin says it's regained control over a border region of Russia held by Ukrainian forces since last summer. NPR's Charles Maines reports from Moscow.
In comments aired on state television, the head of Russia's armed forces, Valery Gerasimov, informed President Vladimir Putin that Russian forces, with support from North Korean infantry, had fully liberated Russia's Kursk region. The border region had been partially occupied by Ukrainian forces following a surprise offensive last August. While Russian control over Kursk could not be independently confirmed, Putin insisted Russia's success would soon be felt across the front line, bringing Ukraine's military defeat closer. The apparent vow to secure an outright military victory comes a day after Putin appeared to stall on a U.S.-backed peace plan that would have rewarded the Kremlin with most of the territory it already had seized from Ukraine. Charles Maines, NPR News, Moscow.
Attorney General Pam Bondi has rescinded a policy that provided protections for journalists. NPR's Ryan Lucas reports.
Bondi announced the changes in a memo to Justice Department employees. The document, obtained by NPR, says the department will not tolerate the unauthorized disclosure of sensitive information to the media. The new policy allows for the use of subpoenas, court orders, and search warrants to compel production of information and testimony by journalists. Such actions must be approved by DOJ leadership. Reporters must be given advance notice, and the requests must be as narrow as possible. The policy change comes as news outlets continue to report stories with leaked information that has angered the administration. The Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press says in a statement that strong protections for journalists serve the public by safeguarding the free flow of information. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News. President Trump has approved a major disaster declaration for Kentucky. Stan Ingold from member station WEKU reports the state is recovering from widespread flooding that caused extensive damage to homes and businesses this month.
The president approved individual assistance for Kentuckians in 13 of the counties affected by the most recent flooding. The governor's request also included public assistance for 33 counties and hazard mitigation for the entire state. Those portions of the request are still pending. The governor will request that additional counties be added to the declaration through an amendment once ongoing assessments are complete. Seven Kentuckians died as a result of the flooding earlier this month. This is the second major flooding event in Kentucky in 3 months. Kentucky was recently denied federal public assistance in two counties, as well as federal individual assistance for families in six other counties affected by February's flood event. For NPR News, I'm Stan Engold in Richmond, Kentucky.
House Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries says it's unlikely lawmakers will support any invasion of Greenland. Jeffries spoke in Copenhagen while on a visit to Denmark with other members of Congress.
The relationship between our two countries is important, has been strong, and must remain that way moving forward.
President Trump has repeatedly said he wants the U.S. to take over Greenland and has not ruled out the use of force. This is NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Pope Francis was laid to rest today in Rome. It was a final farewell for a pope of many firsts, the first pope from Latin America, the first Jesuit, the first to take the name Francis after St. Francis of Assisi, who gave up his riches to become poor. Joining us from the edge of St. Peter's Square is NPR's religion correspondent Jason DeRose. Jason, thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
Let me begin by asking you first of your overall impressions of today's funeral mass.
A very large congregation this morning. Authorities are estimating about 250,000 people in and around St. Peter's Square. And the funeral service itself, a traditional Catholic Requiem Mass, a service that asks God to grant the person who's died eternal rest. Also, a service that expanded the traditional Latin Mass by having prayers in a variety of languages. This one in Arabic calls on the church to be leaven for renewal in the human family.
Of course, Jason, it's traditional that the Dean of the College of Cardinals presides at a pope's funeral. Tell us who that man is and what he said.
Giovanni Battista Re led the service and gave the homily. It's a fitting conclusion, I think, since it was Re who chaired the conclave that elected Francis as Pope 12 years ago. In the Gospel reading today, Jesus asks the disciple Simon Peter, "Do you love me?" three times. And Simon Peter keeps saying yes, and Jesus keeps responding, "Feed my flock." Here's how Re applied that text to Francis during the homily. This is an English translation from the Associated Press.
Papa Francesco.
Pope Francis always placed the gospel of mercy at the center, repeatedly emphasizing that God never tires of forgiving us.
And Ray said Francis led a church capable of bending down to every person and healing their wounds.
And Jason, I gather that Pope Francis chose that gospel passage himself for his funeral. What do you think that might tell us about the way he saw his role?
Scott, the idea of shepherd was a theme throughout his ministry. From the time he was a seminarian in Argentina, through being a local bishop in Buenos Aires, and all the way to being pope. The idea that he was with his flock, in the field, caring for them, tending to their needs, whether they were poor or refugees displaced by war or famine. But you know, Scott, it could also be that Francis chose this passage as one final, not so subtle admonition to the cardinals here today, who'll be electing the next pope. This is what a leader is, he might have been saying. You feed your flock, you care for the poor, because it's what Jesus told his disciples to do.
And of course, the burial followed the funeral mass, but the Pope was not buried at the Vatican, was he?
Well, Francis' body was taken out of Vatican City over the Tiber River to the Basilica of St. Mary Major. By choosing that site, he'll be the first pope in several centuries to be buried outside the Vatican, another and final break with tradition for a pope who was informed by tradition and guided by tradition and nurtured by tradition, but not constrained by it. At St. Mary Major, Francis' body was welcomed by the very people he spent his ministry focused on, specifically homeless people, refugees, transgender people, victims of violence.
And Jason, what unfinished business did Pope Francis leave for the church?
Well, certainly dealing in a definitive way with clergy sexual abuse, that's unfinished. Time and again, he had trouble making progress in this area, sometimes by his own admission, because he failed to see the magnitude of the problem, other times because of church bureaucracy. And there was real hope in recent years among many that the Catholic Church would allow women to serve as deacons in the church, but that did not happen under Francis. Now, that said, many conservative Catholics would argue the focus on these issues, abuse and the role of women, are ultimately divisive and distracting.
Jason, you covered Francis during his 12-year papacy. What do you think you might remember most about him?
Well, I think about the issues Francis clearly cared about: refugees, migrants, the poor, those who have the least power in society. Those were the people Jesus cares about in the Gospels. And I think Francis spent his life teaching that Christians best demonstrate their love for God by serving their neighbors the way Jesus did. It really, I think, Scott, comes back to the Gospel reading Francis chose for today, Jesus saying, "Feed my flock."
NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose, just outside of St. Peter's Square. Jason, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And we'll have more on the legacy of Pope Francis elsewhere on the program. To Sudan now, where a bloody civil war exploded onto the streets of the capital of Khartoum one sleepy Saturday morning just over 2 years ago. The fighting between the Sudanese armed forces and their former ally, the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, has now engulfed the entire country. Africa's largest war led to the world's largest humanitarian crisis, with reports of large-scale famine and genocide in the remote western region. The Sudanese army recaptured Khartoum just over a month ago, and for the first time, the world can now see what's left of the city. And NPR's Emmanuel Akinwotu was just there and joins us now from the de facto capital of Port Sudan. Emmanuel, thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What did you see?
Well, it was surreal. You know, before the war, this was just a really vibrant, proud city, over 6 million people. And now it's been emptied. There's so much destruction from buildings that are completely torched, almost like a matchstick, or covered in bullet holes, bombed or looted. And that's from everyday areas to the presidential palace, museums. At the moment, there's a very small wave of people returning, mainly the lower classes or people with very few choices of where else they can be. But they're coming back to a city with virtually no state services, although the government, at the moment, they're working to revive it. I left Khartoum yesterday, and they were just beginning this process to start cleaning and repairing the city. There were several tractors clearing debris, sweepers cleaning the streets, so much bullet casing, gun boxes, unexploded missiles that they were coming across, even human remains. In parts of central Khartoum, you can even smell it.
Emmanuel, what was the toll like, can you tell, for the human beings who lived there in Khartoum?
Yeah, just immense, really, on multiple levels. You know, I spoke to an activist who told me that when the RSF moved into her area, they committed just wholesale abuses, from sexual violence to beating and torture. They converted the main prison in Khartoum into their own detention center, and even converted schools, hospitals, clinics into essentially detention centers where they tortured and starved people. At the same time, being there, it was also so fascinating to see how people were also reuniting with people they hadn't seen since the war started. Our producer, Amar Awad, he's Sudanese, and more or less every area that we went to in Khartoum, he was finding people he hadn't heard from in more than 2 years. At one stage, he went to his childhood home and he met his neighbors, and they just had this really moving embrace and catch up because his neighbor had stayed in this area that the RSF had occupied. He told him that he suffered a lot, but he was just glad to be alive.
Sudan is routinely now referred to as the world's largest humanitarian crisis. But what does a phrase like that actually look like?
Well, the first thing is just the level of hunger and starvation. Almost all the hospitals in Khartoum city have been shut down or destroyed. Since the Sudanese army recaptured it, people have now been able to move freely and go to the nearest medical centers they can, which is in the city across the Nile, Omdurman. There's one main pediatric hospital, and we went there and the wards were absolutely filled with extremely malnourished children. Each bed had two, sometimes three children. And the hospital told us that they've expanded their capacity over and over throughout the war, and yet they're struggling to meet the soaring need. There are these community kitchens in Sudan that have really been a lifeline during the war, but they're stretched extremely thin, and especially because of aid cuts like to USAID. That aid funding and other aid funding has been cut, and the level of desperation is really huge. But at the same time, you know, even the last few days that we were there, we could see aid trucks from the UN finally really pouring into Khartoum and trying to meet this incredible need.
Where is the fighting now?
Well, it's still on the outskirts of the capital region, and in the mornings you could still hear bombing. The Sudanese army have been striking the RSF with artillery shelling, trying to drive them out from the capital region entirely. The intense fighting has moved to areas towards West Sudan, especially in the area of Darfur, where the RSF are largely in control, except for one city called Al Fashir. And the RSF have essentially been bombarding this city for several months, and there's intense fighting there and a lot of desperation because there was a huge refugee camp hosting more than 500,000 people. And the RSF took it over a few weeks ago, and that has displaced about 400,000 refugees. So the situation there is extremely critical, and the fighting is still ongoing in different parts of Sudan.
NPR's Emmanuel Akinwotu in Sudan, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to NPR News.
I'm Windsor Johnston with these headlines. Hundreds of thousands of people filled St. Peter's Square and the surrounding streets in Rome to pay their final respects to Pope Francis today. Francis died on Monday at the age of 88. Talks aimed at curbing Iran's nuclear program ended today in Oman and may resume next week. Officials from the U.S. and Tehran are negotiating details of an agreement that could result in the lifting of economic sanctions on Iran. The governor of Wisconsin is accusing the White House of undermining the judiciary. His comments come after a county judge in Milwaukee was arrested Friday and accused of helping a Mexican national avoid federal immigration authorities. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Capital One, offering their premium travel card Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. From the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at Skoll.org. And from Imaginable Futures, celebrating the hard work, commitment, and achievements of the 1 in 5 college students who are parents. More at imaginablefutures.com.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. The United Nations says it has no more food to deliver to Palestinians in Gaza. Its food stocks have run out. And that is the sound of Palestinians this week pushing their way through a line at a food kitchen that's run by the UN in central Gaza. They are all hoping to get a plate of rice. Tomorrow it will be 8 weeks since Israel stopped all aid, including food, from entering the territory. Israel says the blockade is a tactic to try to force Hamas to release the remaining Israeli hostages who are still held in Gaza. NPR's Hadil Al-Shalchi joins us from Tel Aviv. Hadil, thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning, Scott.
No aid since the beginning of March. What's the current situation like?
Right. So the UN's World Food Program announced yesterday that it has run out of food stocks that it supplies to charity kitchens that make meals for Palestinians. You know, about half of Gaza's population depends on these kitchens. Israel says it's blocked the aid because it wants Hamas to hand over more hostages, and it accuses Hamas of stealing the aid. But the UN says that very little is actually diverted, and humanitarian groups are calling the blockade a starvation tactic and potentially a war crime.
And Adil, what are you able to hear from Palestinians in Gaza? What are they eating?
Yeah. So NPR's producer in Gaza, Anas Baba, went to one of these charity kitchens in central Gaza and spoke to Nader Khatoun. He was in line to get that one plate of rice to feed his family of seven. He says the situation is catastrophic. There's no food, clean water, and life is just impossible. You know, Enes himself has also told us he's been struggling to find food and the cash to buy it because, you know, some other aid groups still have food stocks and there is still some food in the markets, but they're all quickly diminishing because no new goods are coming into Gaza. And the UN says the price of food in those markets has soared by as much as 1,400%.
Israel is trying to use aid to pressure Hamas into a new deal and return the hostages. Any progress on that?
I mean, short answer is not really. You know, what we do know is that this week, Israel said the head of Mossad met with Qatari officials in Doha, and Hamas said it sent a delegation to Cairo, and some talks with Egyptian mediators started today with them. But this is basically where we've been at for the past couple of months. You know, Hamas is still insisting on a full end to the war before releasing any more hostages, and Israel says it wants a short-term ceasefire that would see some more of the hostages released. And they said that they just won't stop until Hamas is completely defeated. And we know that the Trump administration has made it very clear that it backs Israel.
And this week, a far-right Israeli cabinet member got a very warm reception here in the U.S. Tell us about his visit.
That's right. So ultra-nationalist security minister Itamar Ben-Gvir was in the U.S. this week. You know, during the Biden administration, ultra-nationalist politicians like Ben-Gvir were persona non gratas for things like their extremist, racist views on Arabs. But while Ben-Gvir didn't meet with President Trump this week, he did attend an event at Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort. He said he met with senior Republican officials there. He didn't name them, though. And after the meeting, he said he has support for his position on Gaza, which includes bombing food aid depots there as a means to pressure Hamas to return the hostages. But it wasn't all warm. Anti-Gaza war protesters threw bottles at him, and apparently they didn't miss when he was leaving an event hosted by a Jewish group at Yale University.
NPR's Hadil Al-Shalchi in Tel Aviv, thanks so much for being with us.
You're very welcome.
Some fired federal employees have received even more unwelcome news in recent days. It involves their government health insurance. They thought they still had a couple of more weeks of coverage. Now, some are learning they may have been cut off weeks ago. NPR's Andrea Hsu joins us. Andrea, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
Who are these employees?
Well, the people I've spoken with all work for the Department of Commerce in different areas, and they were fired back in late February and early March, you know, as part of the Trump administration's purge of newer hires or probationary employees. Now, you'll remember these firings happened so suddenly and so chaotically that there were immediate questions over whether they were legal. And in fact, within weeks, a federal judge had ordered agencies to reinstate these workers, at least temporarily. But then several weeks after that, an appeals court found fault with that order and voided it. And the Commerce Department fired everyone again the very next day.
So what happened to their health insurance?
Well, that is the million-dollar question. You know, the federal government, like any big employer, has policies about benefits. And when these Commerce Department employees were first fired, many of them were told that their health insurance would end 31 days after their last pay period. That would have been April 8th. But the confusion began when they were reinstated. I've spoken with about a half dozen of these employees, and each one struggled at that point to get an answer to the basic question, do we have our health insurance back?
HR couldn't answer that?
No, you know, a lot of them have heard nothing. And for some, it was a pressing question. I spoke with Yael Said Green back in January. She had scheduled arthroscopic hip surgery for April 9th. And here's what she said.
I was going back and forth. Do I try and reschedule it? Do I cancel it? Do I keep it? What do I do?
You know, she kept asking her supervisor. And finally, the day before her surgery, she got forwarded an email that said, you know, her insurance was being reinstated. So she showed up for her procedure. She was handed a cost estimate. She paid her $150 copay and she had the surgery. But then, Scott, the very next day, April 10th, while she was in her post-surgical appointment, that's when she learned she was fired again.
And did that mean she was losing her health insurance immediately?
Well, she didn't think so. You know, again, the government has a policy of giving employees 31 days of coverage after they've separated. And also, you know, these employees, they had been paying their premiums, and insurance companies had even sent people new insurance cards after they were reinstated. So even after people had been fired again, you know, many of them kept their medical appointments. Another person I spoke with, Carrie Murphy, had foot surgery on April 17th. That morning, she also called and checked with her insurer to make sure she had coverage and was told she did. But little did she know, on that very day, Yael Said Green and other Commerce Department employees were getting a new memo from the government telling them their insurance had lapsed on April 8th per that original termination date. Now, Carrie Murphy, to be clear, she did not get this memo. She has still not heard anything from the government. But this week, you know, one of her group chats started blowing up with colleagues from her own office saying they had called their insurers and were told their coverage ended April 8th. And now she is too scared to call her insurance company.
This has been such a life-changing, devastating series of events that I don't know how much more bad news I can take.
Without insurance, how will these two people pay for their surgeries?
Well, federal employees do have the option of doing the equivalent of COBRA and paying, you know, to continue their care. And Yael Said Green said she'll probably do that for a month because that cost estimate she received showed that even the negotiated insurance rate for her surgery was more than $17,000. Carrie Murphy, she had her whole family on her government plan. And continuing that plan, she thinks will cost her close to $3,000 a month. It's money she doesn't have because she just lost her job. Meanwhile, you know, she has an appointment next week to get her bandages removed, and she may have to cancel that.
Andrea, what does the Trump administration have to say about all this?
Well, we sent detailed questions to the Commerce Department about this insurance mess and got no reply. We also reached out to the Office of Personnel Management, and they just referred us to general benefits information. I did speak with an outside expert on federal employee benefits, and she said, you know, we've never had a situation where people have been fired, rehired, and fired again. So this is all unknown territory.
And NPR's Andrea Hsu, thanks so much.
Thanks, Scott.
Journalist and Nobel Prize winner Maria Ressa has covered abuses of power in the Philippines. She now has some advice for Americans.
Do not voluntarily give up your rights, because it's going to take far more energy later on to claw back the rights that are guaranteed by the Constitution.
Later today on All Things Considered, you can listen on your radio, your smartphone, or your smart speaker. And so nice to say, and now it's time for sports. Remembering the holiest of soccer fans, the NFL draft, the NHL playoffs, and for the first time live, Michelle Steele of ESPN joins us in her studios. Michelle, thanks so much for being with us.
Gosh, it's great to be here, Scott, but I have to ask you, where in the heck is BJ Lederman, who wrote the theme music to this august and distinguished show?
He's home listening very avidly to what you're going to say, Michelle.
Of course.
Thanks for being with us. And let's begin by remembering Pope Francis, a lifelong fan of the Buenos Aires Soccer Football Club San Lorenzo. Club made an announcement this week on how they're going to honor the late pontiff, didn't they?
Yeah, Scott, they said that they're actually naming their new stadium after him. They're going to call it Papa Francisco Stadium. And apparently, and understandably, he was quite emotional when they informed him that they would like to honor him in this way. Pope Francis loved the beautiful game. He was a soccer fan longer than he was a priest. He actually grew up going to these games with his father as a young kid. He was a card-carrying member of the club. And you know what, Scott? Mm-hmm. His number on his card, 88235, corresponded exactly with his age and the time in Argentina when he passed. Maybe divine inspiration there.
Yeah. From football to football, because the NFL draft began Thursday. No surprises at the top. Titans picked Cam Ward, first pick overall. But the big surprise that didn't happen, Shador Sanders, the Colorado quarterback, fell out of the first round, then the second, now the third. Now, look, there's a celebrated history, right, of great quarterbacks who weren't drafted until the later rounds, and for that matter, first-round picks who washed out. But what do you think's at work here?
Gosh, I have been watching the draft now for decades. You've been watching the draft for a very long time. I have never seen in my lifetime a slide like this one. This was a guy a couple weeks ago. People projected him as a very, very possible first round pick, and certainly at least gone by the third round. He won the Johnny Unitas Award this past season for the best senior quarterback in the country. He had something like a 70% completion percentage in college. He built a custom room in his house, Scott, for the draft. Oh. I'm kind of getting tired of looking at those custom pillows on that custom couch for the draft. Even quarterback needy teams, I'm talking about the Saints, the Seahawks, the Browns, passing on this guy. Yeah. The reporting is he didn't interview well. The NFL is a place where you have to earn it every day. And if they get the sense that you're not in it for all the right reasons, quote unquote, they're going to pass on you. Now, that doesn't mean they're right. They could be wrong. I'd love for Shador to prove them wrong. We'll see what happens. He should be gone today based on his performance on the field in these later rounds, but not so far.
I mean, they never picked Kurt Warner, who, you know.
Sure. And we know where Tom Brady went, right?
Yeah.
But Tom Brady wasn't projected to go in the first, second, or third rounds either.
You consulted some especially eminent opinion on the NFL draft this week.
Very eminent. A friend of the show. Austin Goolsbee, the president of the Chicago Federal Reserve. Now, you might be asking, what does Goolsbee have to say about the draft? Quite a bit. He oversees the upper Midwest, which, of course, includes Green Bay. And you know what? In this economy, sports has been a bright spot. And he told me this week that one of the most patriotic things you could do, apparently, as an American, as far as our economic recovery, is to watch the NFL draft, because sports is not affected as much by the tariffs or all the trade activity and all that. But apparently, they're projecting $100 million in economic activity for the state of Wisconsin. So good for them. That's a lot of cheese.
Mercy from the that's a lot of cheese heads, too. Look, an important week for Canada. Oh, yeah, there's an election on Monday. But before that, the Toronto Maple Leafs and the Ottawa Senators. It's 3-0 right now. Toronto leads. Can a Canadian team finally end Canada's Stanley Cup draft?
Right. It might be Canada's sport, but the Stanley Cup has lived in the United States, Scott, since 1993. I actually interviewed a Canadian player last year on the Panthers and asked him if he wanted that Canadian drought to continue as a red-blooded Canadian. And he was like, that's the idea. I play for the Florida Panthers. We want to win the cup. That is what happened. The Leafs will likely beat the Senators tonight. I don't think the Leafs are the Canadian team to win the Cup. Look at the Winnipeg Jets. They have the best record in the regular season, Scott. They have the best goalie in the regular season. They have a good shot among all teams, not just the Canadians. So that's what I have to say about Canadian hockey this morning.
Michelle Steele, what an absolute pleasure to have you with us. Thanks so much.
I didn't think you'd be in full Cubs uniform this morning, but I love your enthusiasm.
I'm always in Cubs uniform. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. New Orleans' much-anticipated Jazz and Heritage Festival is underway, and while Lil Wayne may have been disappointed he wasn't selected to perform at the Super Bowl this year, he's now headlining Jazz Fest, making his festival debut today. As Joseph King with the Gulf States Newsroom reports, it's a big moment for hip-hop artists in the city.
New Orleans and music are synonymous. Jazz music and brass bands may be the first things that come to mind for most people. But over the last couple of decades, you can't mention music in New Orleans without bounce or hip-hop in the conversation. At Jazz Fest, you can hear a little bit of everything, from rock and bluegrass to Alfred Banks. He says if you're a musician from New Orleans, you want to perform there.
Jazz Fest is kind of like the local, I guess you could say, mecca for performance.
Banks is a rapper born and raised in Uptown New Orleans. He has performed a few times at Jazz Fest, mostly on the smaller stage.
Like, that's just where you play. Like, if you're a black artist, you know you're playing Congress Square Stage.
Banks says it seems rap artists, whether national or local, tend to play that stage.
It does feel like no matter how big you get or how much notoriety you get, you're probably playing Congress Square, and that's just kind of where the artists go.
But one rapper who won't be on that stage this year is New Orleans' own Lil Wayne. Banks says that's because he will share the main stage with The Roots, the Tonight Show band.
I don't know if I'd be wrong to say this, but I don't think he would have got booked if he didn't have The Roots with him. You know what I mean?
Getting Lil Wayne, of course, is a real coup.
That's Lewis Edwards. He's the associate producer of Jazz Fest. He controls a lot of the creative elements at the festival.
That name has definitely been on a post-it on my desk for a long time.
Then last summer, he saw Lil Wayne perform with The Roots at a concert in Philadelphia. Seeing him with a live band, Edwards was convinced that they would be a great fit for the main stage in New Orleans.
That was new, that was fresh. We felt like it was something that would play really well at the festival. We love it when the music is really acoustic and it's live, and this was going to deliver that.
Locally, Jazz Fest is sometimes known as Dad Fest, but Edwards says it caters to every generation and has embraced hip-hop since its inception.
Whether it's, you know, Juvenile and Onas, Common, Drake has played Jazz Fest. I don't know that, you know, those artists are thought of as just appealing to middle-aged people.
Another rapper on the main stage right before Lil Wayne is none other than the queen of bounce herself, Big Freedia.
Jazz Fest is expanding their horizon, and they are trying to bring more of our black folks to come in to support the Jazz Fest.
Big Freedia has performed all over the world, but says it's nothing like performing at home.
You get to see the local acts, you get to see the Mardi Gras Indians and the whole cultural thing behind that. You get to, you know, experience all of these different, you know, food vendors, and, you know, it's just no experience like that.
Her music is a testament of how hip-hop intersects with a variety of genres and fits seamlessly into the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival. For NPR News, I'm Joseph King. Watch me catch the spirit, but I'm a never fly spirit. I ain't gonna do it. Always keep it in first class. Heaven stamped on my ticket. Hair, press, dress, down, nails, done, for the one. Amen. When they see me, no, I ain't nothing to play with. Holy water, drifting, clutter, all designer, father, father. Oh, yes. Breaking necks in my Sunday best. Sunday best. What?
This is NPR News.
After the funeral, the conclave, Vincent Nichols will be there.
When those doors shut, all of the, you know, it's conservative against liberal and all of that stuff, that will finish.
The thoughts and prayers of one cardinal as he prepares to vote for the next pope. That and all the latest news Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
I'm Windsor Johnston with these headlines. World leaders, dignitaries, and hundreds of thousands of people attended the funeral of Pope Francis at the Vatican today. The service came 6 days after the pontiff made his final public appearance in St. Peter's Square to celebrate Easter. Health officials in Gaza say at least 10 people, including children, were killed by an Israeli airstrike today. The attack on a neighborhood in western Gaza destroyed a three-story home. It comes as mediators are hoping to restart ceasefire talks. Indian and Pakistani troops have exchanged gunfire for a second straight night along the border in Kashmir. The gunfire follows last week's deadly attack on tourists in the disputed region. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Indiana University, establishing the IU Launch Accelerator for Biosciences to drive healthcare discoveries and train the next generation of innovators. More at go.iu.edu/IULab. And from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. This is NPR.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Pope Francis was the first non-European pope in more than 1,000 years. In Mexico, he was beloved for being Latino, and also, as NPR's Eder Peralta reports, for a special encounter with the Virgin of Guadalupe.
The Basilica of Our Lady of Guadalupe here in Mexico City is the most important Catholic shrine in the Americas. The church sits at the foot of Tepeyac Hill, where in 1531, Catholics believe the Virgin Mary appeared before Juan Diego, an indigenous man. She left her image on his mantle and helped play a part in the mass conversion of Latin America. Millions come here every year to stand before that mantle. Sister Candelaria Garcia Alvarez had just left the church and had stopped to pay her respects in front of a picture of Pope Francis. She says she remembers what the Virgin told Juan Diego, "Let not your heart be sad. I am here. I am your mother."
Entonces pienso que todo mundo encontramos como este cobijo.
And so I think we all find that refuge here, she says. In 2016, Pope Francis gave a mass here. Afterward, he did what millions of Latin Americans do. He brought the Virgin flowers. Father Daniel Preciado was there that day.
Estuvo prácticamente 20 minutos frente a la imagen de la Santísima Virgen María.
He sat silently in front of her image for some 20 minutes. He adds jokingly, until they basically told him it was time to go. Pope Francis was already beloved because he was Latino, but that moment, said Father Preciado, sealed a bond. Latin Americans from the whole continent flocked to this shrine at some of their toughest moments, praying for a miracle and hoping for comfort. And here was a pope doing exactly the same thing.
Él sabía que por la misión que tenía, pues tenía que estar protegido por la Santísima Virgen María.
He knew because of the tough mission ahead, he needed protection from the Virgin Mary. At the Basilica, they've hung a huge picture of the Pope showing his moment with the Virgin. In front of his portrait outside, they've given him the same yellow roses he brought the Virgin. Benjamin Cordova Garcia said the encounter reminded him of a Mexican proverb.
Decimos, quien quiere a la madre, quiere a los hijos.
We say, whoever loves the mother loves her children, he says. And he showed such respect and honor and affection to our mother.
De alguna manera sentimos como que, pues otro hermano, ¿no?
It made us feel, he says, like he was just one of our brothers. Eder Peralta, NPR News, Mexico City.
Hundreds of Yemeni coffee shops have opened around the U.S. just within the past few years. Yemen is an ancient birthplace of the coffee trade, and immigrants fleeing the civil war there have brought their culture here in the form of cafes. NPR's Netta Ulaby has a report from one of them near Detroit.
There's a popular chain of Yemeni coffee shops called Kahwa House. Kahwa means coffee. Ibrahim Al-Hasbani founded the first Kahwa house here in Michigan only 9 years ago. Now there are more than 20, from New York to Texas, with more on the way.
I want to share the culture, I want to share the coffee, I want to share the history.
Kahwa House coffee shops, like this one in Dearborn, are airy, elegant, serving small batch coffee grown by Yemeni farmers.
We have the pour over, we have the espresso, we have the latte, we have everything in one place.
Including rolls filled with sweet cheese and caramel chocolate cake.
The desserts are just phenomenal. Most coffee shops you go and you get nice pastries, but not really to the same kind of level.
That's Finn Pooler. He writes about the specialty coffee industry in his newsletter, The Pour Over. Pooler's followed the rise of Yemeni coffee shops in the U.S. He says the coffee enjoys a mystique due to its rich history and flavor. But does Yemeni coffee live up to the hype?
Yes, generally speaking, as far as I've tasted. I think probably that is partly because the coffee that's made it to us recently has been really the best of the best.
All over the world, coffee prices have skyrocketed, mostly due to climate change, says Pooler. That affects exports everywhere.
There's like hijackings, there's people holding on to coffee because they don't want to sell it, because obviously the price can keep going up.
Most coffee consumed in the U.S. comes from Latin America. It's subject to the same 10% tariffs as coffee from Yemen. Al-Hasbani gets his from a family farm near the capital, Sana'a. It must travel a treacherous path hundreds of miles south.
So usually before the war was like 10 hours driving to take the shipment from Sana'a to the port. With the war, it takes like 2 days sometimes because they have to take a different way and they have to deal with too many groves in the ground. We have to choose a special driver. We have to choose a special route how we're going to get it to the port.
It's kind of a miracle any coffee makes it, says entrepreneur Mukhtar Al-Kanchali.
You know, the Yemeni cafe movement is very, very new. I get really emotional when I walk into these cafes and I see Yemen coffee becoming a thing in the last 2 years. This thing is just starting right now. It's just kicking off and it could be blocked because of unfortunate policies.
Al-Kanchali is the hero of a nonfiction best-selling book written by Dave Eggers. The Monk of Mocha from 2018 followed his quest to bring single-origin Yemeni coffee to the United States.
Most farmers in Yemen are smallholder farmers. They rely on these coffee trees in their villages.
Houthi rebels operating around these villages have been designated by the Trump administration as a terrorist organization. U.S. intelligence in Yemen is limited, and Al-Kanchali worries that supporting Yemeni coffee farmers could lead to charges of materially supporting terrorism.
90% of Yemen coffee, I would say, comes from the territories that are controlled by the Houthis in Yemen, the mountain regions across Ib and Sana'a and these provinces.
Money might trickle down to people involved with the Houthis.
War affect everyone, yeah.
Ibrahim Al-Hasbani does not like to talk politics. He'd rather discuss the high tariffs on Chinese-made paper coffee cups than, understandably, the political consequences of buying coffee from a family farm. But Al-Hasbani was dismayed by jokes from political commentators when a journalist was accidentally included on a group chat among high-level U.S. officials planning to bomb Yemeni targets. The war in Yemen has killed hundreds of thousands of people, partly because of lethal damage to infrastructure.
I lost my mom 1 year and a half in Yemen. She was sick, and you know how the hospital in Yemen is really, really bad.
He also lost his sister. When the officials used emojis to celebrate airstrikes in the city of Sana'a, Mukhtar Al-Kanchali was horrified.
Terrified my family. And you're talking about a city that has over 3 million people that live in it. Sana'a was attacked in really high density residential neighborhoods, which hadn't happened that way before in a long time, actually.
U.S. airstrikes are continuing in Yemen. It is so much easier to see people as human beings, says Ibrahim Al-Hasbani, when you actually see them. That might mean these days at a Yemeni coffee shop. He wants Kahwa House to be a welcoming place that helps Americans recognize Yemenis, he says, not as people associated with war and famine, but as the people who brought the world coffee.
We are behind every smile in the morning.
Neda Ulibi, NPR News.
James Gandolfini played Tony Soprano in the HBO series for 6 seasons, ending in 2007. And The Sopranos was considered an instant classic. The New Jersey mob family, headed by a boss who had to fret about rival mobs, FBI stings, as well as his own family, all while dealing with growing older and his crime family scrambling to survive. tried to work through some of that with his therapist, played by Lorraine Bracco.
You know where I was yesterday when you called? I was outside a house. Well, the guy that works for me was inside beating the of a guy that owes me money. Broke his arm. Put a bullet in his kneecap.
How'd that make you feel?
Wished it was me in there.
James Gandolfini, who was acclaimed as the Marlon Brando of television, at times struggled with that tough guy persona and the glare of celebrity. He died in 2013 at the age of 51. Jason Bailey, the film critic and historian, has written a new book, Gandolfini, Jim, Tony, and the Life of a Legend. He joins us from our studios in New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a real pleasure.
What made you say to yourself, this was a life and talent that needs their story to be told?
I felt like he was such an enormous talent. He was an actor of such tremendous skill, but was also an actor of incredible range, which I don't think people talk about as much. You know, Tony Soprano and The Sopranos had such an outsized influence and sort of cast such a giant shadow over television and over popular culture in general that Tony Soprano is what everyone thinks of when they think of James Gandolfini. And I understand why that is. But I felt like his story was one of, first of all, of a working class actor who considered himself a character actor and aimed only to be that, and was sort of became an unlikely star, which I think is always of interest to people, who struggled after that show ended to continue to grow as an artist in spite of sort of the box that that show put him in, which I think is fascinating. And more than anything, I would hear these stories, mostly after his passing, from friends, from colleagues, of his tremendous character, of his personal generosity and kindness. And I certainly was fascinated by the sort of incongruity between that and the persona of his most famous character.
He really was a Jersey guy, wasn't he?
Yeah. He was not far at all removed from his Italian roots, very much a working class background. You know, his father was a bricklayer when he was younger. And I think that background is really important to understanding who he was as an actor and who he was as a person.
He was a part-time bartender and a student at Rutgers.
Mm-hmm.
And his girlfriend.
Yeah.
Lynn Marie Jacobson died in a car crash. Do you think this kind of changed direction in his life?
It did. He talked about it only on a couple of occasions, but one of them was one of his Emmy acceptance speeches. He thanked her, he dedicated the award to her, and said, she made me want to be an actor. And what he meant by that was, you know, he had tinkered with acting on stage as a high school student and loved it. But, you know, he was a working class guy, and the arts is not something you go into. And when he went to Rutgers, he didn't take advantage of their wonderful theater program. He studied, you know, communications and journalism so he could get like a real job. And I think losing someone he cared for so deeply really sort of reconfigured his priorities in terms of the kind of life he wanted to live, and realizing that he did want to be an artist and that it was okay to pursue that.
He got some early notices, especially in a production with Alec Baldwin of A Streetcar Named Desire, but he was not a marquee name when he auditioned for the role of Tony Soprano, was he?
He was not. He had carved out a very nice space for himself as a character actor in the 1990s, you know, starting with Tony Scott's True Romance. You know, it's a small role, but he has one incredibly memorable scene, and it's kind of a big monologue as a Quentin Tarantino screenplay. And so throughout the 90s, he would pop up in small but memorable supporting roles. And I think that's the kind of actor that he saw himself as.
What do you think he came to see in Tony Soprano?
I think Tony's vulnerability is a huge piece of why that character was one that he could relate to. A lot of the tough guys that he had played up until then had been sort of one-dimensional stereotypes, basically, which was what he was trying to avoid. But what made Tony Soprano compelling to him as an actor was the same thing that made him compelling to us as an audience, which was that he had all of these multitudes, that he had sensitivity, vulnerability, weakness. And also, I think part of the reason why we found his performance so compelling was a lot of those same contradictions existed within him.
There came a time when he held out for a pay raise after the show became a success.
Yes.
But it was extraordinary how he spread it around.
it became sort of the talk of the tabloids at the time. And the thing you have to understand about The Sopranos, especially for, you know, East Coast media, was that at its height, there was no story about The Sopranos that was too small for coverage. He felt that the kind of money that other actors were getting on network shows for, frankly, a lot less work than he was doing, those salaries had grown so large at that time. He was generating so much money for HBO. So he and his team saw that he was in kind of a power position and renegotiated and got a nice salary bump. And then when he went back to set, he called each of the supporting players for the show into his trailer one by one, handed them each a check for $36,000 and said, thanks for standing by me.
What was happening when there came a time when James Gandolfini didn't show up for work?
The thing you have to understand about him and this show was that this was a level of fame that he had never wanted, had never anticipated. It was sort of a public pressure that he was not prepared for. And there got to be some days where he just didn't come to work. He would often warn people. He would say, I'm not coming in tomorrow. I spoke to a lot of the cast and crew about this. There isn't really a consensus because there would be different reasons. Sometimes it was just all of the work had gotten him. Sometimes there was a really difficult scene that he didn't feel like he was ready for. Sometimes he just had been out all weekend and it was Monday morning and he'd had a heavy weekend and he just couldn't make it in. He also was wrestling with what nearly every person I talked to classified as demons. You know, that there were demons of addiction. There were demons of self-doubt and of sort of succumbing to that pressure. And that was his coping mechanism. But what's fascinating about any of the sort of issues that you hear about is that they would all tell me those things, but not one of them would badmouth him in any way.
You venture to guess what James Gandolfini would think about your book if he were still with us today.
This was something I was told by Robert Eiler, who played Anthony Jr. on the show, that, you know, one of the constants throughout all of the interviews, everyone who knew him, was that Jim couldn't take a compliment. And so Mr. Eiler believes that Mr. Gandolfini would actually not care for the book at all because he would get very tired of people saying nice things about him in print, that he would find it quite tiresome. And you know what? That's a criticism that I'll respect.
Jason Bailey, his new book, Gandolfini, Jim, Tony, and the Life of a Legend. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you again for having me.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering flowering shrubs and evergreens selected for home landscapes. More at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR. From Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
Cable from England, direct to Trinidad, applauding Cipriani, who celebrates the centenary. A cable from England, direct to Trinidad, applauding Cipriani, who celebrates the centenary. From native of the West Indies, residing in New York City, congratulating Cipriani, who celebrates the centenary.